Small Brains, Big Dreams is a podcast created by the Newborn Brain Society in partnership with the Canadian Premature Babies Foundation. The Newborn Brain Society is a nonprofit organization supporting a world in which all newborns have access to and receive the optimal brain care. We promote international, multidisciplinary collaboration, education, and innovation among clinicians, scientists, and parents. Preemie parent and journalist Jenna Morton is the host of this series, focusing on the role mentorship plays within this discipline.
Welcome to the final episode of the second season of Small Brains, Big Dreams, a podcast created for aspiring and early career neurologists. On this show, we speak with some of the world's most respected researchers about their journey in the field, with a focus on the role mentorship has played in their career. This episode, we feature Dr. Mark Scher, Emeritus Scholar and Professor of Pediatrics and Neurology at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. Dr. Scher is the former chief of the Pediatric Neurology Division at Ohio's UH Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital, which is recognized as one of the United States' leading children's hospitals. As division chief, he established a second fetal neonatal neurology program at University Hospitals of Cleveland while expanding the pediatric neurology service throughout northeastern Ohio, strengthening neonatal pediatric neurocritical care consultations, and establishing a pediatric epilepsy sleep program. Welcome to Small Brains, Big Dreams.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm really looking forward to hearing about your journey, not just in medicine, but your journey into medicine. So I'd love to hear how everything started for you.
Sure. So for all the members who are listening, I'm a child neurologist who got his interest starting before I went to college, but I'll go into that in a second. And I'm now in my eighth decade, but still learning. So whatever you hear today, understand that I'm gonna bring to it all the decades in which I've had the privilege of learning from others, particularly my patients and families, but also my other faculty and younger faculty who are less than half my age. So my dad is now deceased, and so is my mom, but they were a wonderful influence for two reasons to be a pediatric neurologist. First, my dad was kind of an amateur historian and interested in philosophy and religion, all sorts of different disciplines, and he liked to tell me about how the disciplines complement each other. So one of the things I learned from him, which now is reflected in my writing for fetal neonatal neurology, is interdisciplinary. The other thing that my dad pushed, which was very important, was historical context. He was a big history nut. And so he would always talk about the historical context of why was the American Constitution written in the way it was based on the history at the time. So, I mean, I'm a big believer in that. Now, my mother, who I'll never tell my dad this, if they were alive, she was smarter. She graduated at 16 as valedictorian. She taught me stuff that was socially conscious. So anything that was related to disparities, anything that was related to equity, that's where I got it from my mom. Now I have one sibling, an older brother who's 5 years older. He's a doctor, now retired surgeon, but Ken approached his profession in a way that I admired because he was a surgeon in the operating room, which I wasn't gonna become, but he talked about how to best prepare the patient to optimize their surgery and how to best take care of them after the surgery. So he was giving me the approach of how to be a complete doctor for your patient. With that in mind, I left to go to college, and University of Rochester was a wonderful school. I was pre-med. I was a history major to show my dad I was interested in history, but also to get the best I could out of an expensive education. And what I learned, particularly in my sophomore year in two courses, really were pivotal to becoming a child neurologist. The first was a psychology course led by two individuals who are actually part of a national program of study looking at maternal pediatric outcome dealing with neurologic problems. Their names were Arthur Samaroff and John Chandler. And they talked about developmental psychology from the point of view of their experiences. And they taught me a lot to think about because their study that they were in is something that our parents here in the United States paid for. It's called the Collaborative Perinatal Project. And Arthur and John lectured to us, about 200 students, about the importance of this particular study that basically was formed out of monies from the Eisenhower through the Johnson administrations to better understand women and children and their outcomes. After World War II, when the World War was big war was over, we realized that women and children were dying at higher rates. And so the United States and Britain, as well as other countries, put together these sorts of programs. So anyway, author Samaroff and his colleague taught us about this collaborative project through psychology and developmental psychology. At the same sophomore year, I learned about the anatomy of the brain. It was not a developmental course, but it was a course about everything dealing with the brain, from all the way in the peripheral nerves and muscle, all the way up to the higher cortex. And so those two courses in my sophomore year really solidified my interest in child neurology because of the developmental issues and because of the intricacy of neurology. Fast forward, I finished college. I went to medical school. I immersed myself at Downstate Medical School in Brooklyn, a very large medical school, State University of New York, fed into the city hospital system and a private hospital next to it. And I learned a lot about health disparities because of the neighborhood I was in. And my first year in medical school, my first formal mentor besides my college courses was Keetcha Veller. Now, Keetcha was the chief of child neurology, and she had a fellow who was her rotator, Sandy Warren. And the two of them were my first teachers in child neurology. And Keetcha taught me all about how to take a history, do an exam. I got involved in her interests, which have to do with autism and ADHD and all kinds of issues with kids. But she guided me towards child neurology, told me to spend some time abroad, which I did in Denmark, and learned a lot about neurology, child neurology, from Danish neurologists, but also went to Columbia University at the Children's Hospital there before it was called Stanley Hospital. And I learned from Sidney Carter, who at the time was one of the leaders in the country. He and his faculty taught me child neurology as a fourth year medical student. So by the time I left medical school and entered my pediatric residency, I already had child neurologists mentoring me and sharing with me what they thought. But I was also, my ears were open to the neonate, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But in my first training program, I went to pediatrics in Manhattan rather than Brooklyn. New York Hospital was a wonderful training ground, particularly for neonatology. Peter Auld, who was the chair or the division head of neonatology, he taught a heck of a lot of good neonatology. And I, because of my interest in neurology, got to meet lots of pregnant women who had babies who had problems. And so by the time my 2 years were up and I went to Minnesota, I knew that fetal neonatal was my ticket. When I got to Minnesota, my next major mentor, I want to mention by love and credit, because he's a good friend now passed, Ken Swayman. Ken was the founder of the Child Neurology Society. He's the founder of the major journal in neurology. He's the founder of the foundation in child neurology. And Ken was my teacher, along with his faculty. Ken guided me in fetal neonatal neurology because he saw my interest. And through him, I met other faculty at Minnesota who taught me about neonatal EEG and sleep particularly, but also how to be a better child neurologist who thinking about the fetus and the newborn. I got to know Ted Thompson, who was the head of neonatology in Minnesota. It's such a wonderful experience to be in Minnesota because I got out of New York. And being out of New York, I could learn about all kinds of stuff from the Midwest. It's interesting how you get away from the snooty Easterners and you see places in other parts of the country. Well, my teachers in Minnesota said, you know, you need a little more research training before you begin your academic career. And my EEG teacher, Fernando Torres, a wonderful teacher, he suggested I go learn from a mentor at Stanford. Barry Tharp is his name. He's still alive. He's an old man now. Barry was a wonderful teacher. His boss, David Prince, the chairman of neurology, was a wonderful mentor as well. The two of them guided me for my 2 years at Stanford to learn neonatal neurology, not only from EEG sleep, which is what Barry was interested in, but David Prince was a world authority on epilepsy, and he was doing brain cuts. So he was looking at rats and guinea pigs and looking under the microscope of these little neurons when they were alive and assessing them. And he taught me all about, in the laboratory, what the brain is made of. So that mentorship in Stanford was wonderful. But at Stanford, I also met an interdisciplinary group of mentors or teachers. I met Phil Sunshine, the head of neonatology. I met the head of psychiatry, Anders, Tom Anders. I met so many other people that by the time I went to Pittsburgh in 83, finished with my formal training, everybody, but my training was really beginning. I had a wonderful mentorship and teachers. I mean, it takes a village, like the African culture says, and Hillary Clinton made famous. It takes a village to make a mark, sure. And so by the time I reached Pittsburgh and I was a junior faculty, I had two positions, one at McGee Women's Hospital, major women's health center in Pittsburgh, well-known in the United States. I was in the division of neonatology. I rounded every day with a neonatologist for 14 years, while I was also a division member of child neurology. And I also had a position not only in pediatrics and neurology, but also psychiatry. And my mentoring went on, even though I was now faculty. So my mentoring were people who were my same age as me, and sometimes younger, but many times older. One of my major mentors was the chair of psychiatry, Dave Kupfer. Now, Dave put me in touch with his faculty, who got me started on an NIH career, the National Institutes of Health. I was able to get funded for about 15, 20 years. And Dave put me on the path of funding using my neonatal EEG sleep expertise, but I applied it in a more general way. So when I said 14 years of training, I really meant it. I rounded every day with a neonatologist. I learned everything about system by system, what it was to keep the baby alive and get them healthy, or at least get them more healthy. I cut brains with a neuropathologist. I looked at the placenta under the microscope with a placental pathologist. I read imaging. I looked at sonograms with Mike Hill, for instance, the head of sonography. I went to conferences and heard from the geneticists and the MFMs. So for 14 years, my training was in fetal neonatal neurology. And during that period of time, I published and I got my promotion and all that. And that's great. But I still sought out mentorship as a faculty member, even once I was promoted. Well, I decided I want to become a chief of division, and I built a division in Cleveland. So I moved from Pittsburgh to Cleveland and became the chief of child neurology in a division I was forming. My mentorship continued there. I had members. I went to actually Rainbow because of two neonatologists, Richard Martin and Av Fanaroff, who are the major textbook authors for the neonatology in the world. And so I learned from Richard and Av how to be even a better fetal neonatal neurologist. But I also rounded with the MFMs at their conference. I would round with the sick women in the hospital. And so for the next 24 years, I continued my mentorship and interactions. You never stop learning. And as long as you keep your mind open to the fact that you don't know everything, you will learn a lot. And through all of this with mentoring, let me share with you one central thing. The family, together with the child, they're your mentors as well, because they're teaching you individually what their challenges are, and they're all different. And so one of the things that I really learned, particularly when I went to Cleveland, was better communication, shared decisions with your patients. Shared decision with your mothers and fathers and obviously representing their children and the families as well. And I've learned a tremendous amount. And the one thing I think I want the membership of the MBS to understand is we don't know everything as healthcare providers. Prospectively, we learn from sometimes our mistakes, but we learn from incomplete information. But then we get more information if you listen to your patient and watch your patient, and you reassess what your decisions were at a later time. That's called uncertainty. And one of the things you need to and one of my webinars for the MBS was the science of uncertainty. It's a real science. Now, I've transitioned away from my formal academic practice. Sure, 2020, I retired right before COVID, but I met Khorshed Mohammed, the head of the education committee at the MBS. And Mohammed El Deeb, who's ending as president now, and the three of us hit it off. I joined the education committee with Khorshed, and I've enjoyed learning from the small committee. but also learning from the NBS school. We have a lot of great webinars, not only the ones I've contributed, we have over 150, 160 webinars from really good scientists, really good lecturers, and also young lecturers too, and still in their training. And so the NBS and other professional organizations after I ended my academic practice has allowed me to continue on to the present time.
I absolutely love hearing about your career and all the different pathways that people take to get to where they are. What really struck me and what you were just sharing, though, is something that I haven't heard someone else talk about yet on this podcast. And that's the idea of the importance of going outside of your comfort zone, of geographically going to places that are very different than what you've experienced and what you can take from that. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the importance of that and maybe some advice for people who are trying to find their way in that part of the programming.
Well, that's a very good question, because I've learned a lot by pushing myself and challenging myself. There's a psychologist here in the United States, Brené Brown, and she's outside of my field. She's a social worker, and then she got a PhD, and she counsels people under stress and marriages that are a problem, etc. But the one thing she says is you should challenge yourself by things that are outside your comfort zone. And so I've always approached that in a way that prevents me from being siloed. Now, there's a term for that in the academic field. You can think you're the smartest person in the room, but maybe you're talking about just adult neurology or just child neurology or just neonatology. One of the things that I've tried to share in my monologue getting started was it took a village to make me, and that's across disciplines.
What are some of the aspects of medicine right now that are exciting you? You're kind of a little bit on the outside now looking in compared to where you were Sure. The last, 40 years, but there must be things that you're watching closely.
I am. I'm watching closely to make sure the human connection is preserved while maximizing on the artificial intelligence, computer science, informational power that we have using the computer. I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about what challenges that's creating for the younger doctors who have to sit in front of a computer and type when they even interview their patients in clinic. But I think that one of the challenges that can be cashed in on for success is to how keep in control computer assisted learning in a way that helps augment your bedside history and exam. And I really mean that. There's a group in Germany that I'm working with now. Peter Robinson is his name, and he's a friend. And I'm learning more about a project he started back in 2008. It's called the Human Phenotype Ontogeny Project, big name. And what he says was the phenotype. What do we see as patients, as doctors in our patients? What do they look like? How do they act? That's the phenotype. Ontogeny means development. He's a geneticist interested in informational science. And he wants to know what are the genetic codes over time that make for that phenotype. Well, Peter and I are getting together dealing with fetal neonatal neurology because he's got great articles in fields outside of fetal neonatal neurology, and he's done a little work, but he needs to understand what's the phenotype that leads to cerebral palsy. What's the phenotype that leads to autism in kids? What's the phenotype that leads to all sorts of things? So giving you an example of how to harness computers and artificial intelligence and computational science, that's a good example.
I think it's really important you bringing up that idea of the human connection. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you want younger people in the field to think about when it comes to that.
Well, I think that we have a partnership with Betsy Pilon and her group, Hope for HIE. That's a good example. These are families that have been through the pain of a child with encephalopathy, maybe from HIE. And so one of the things that I draw strength from, and I wrote just a paper this January in Frontiers in Neurology on the science of uncertainty, which I use case reports. And I tried to show what I've learned from the mothers who had the babies with neurologic problems, what were the challenges they had in decisions? Well, one of the things I'm learning, which others have written about, is that's not your decision as the doctor or nurse. I'm not Moses coming down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and two tablets. I've got to listen to them. So it's a shared decision process. And sometimes the family's values and beliefs have to have greater relevance than what I don't know. I don't want them to make the wrong decisions, but I also don't want to give them the wrong advice. So shared decision-making, and this is something that I'm learning from very younger colleagues in the field. Monica Lemon is a good example. Monica is at Duke, and Monica trained at Hopkins, and then she went to Duke, and she's an expert on neuropalliative care. So she looks at children who are really neurologically impaired and challenged, and the families that have to deal with that. And that becomes a major issue with shared decision-making under the stresses of that particular experience. So if that answers your question.
It does, yeah. And I wonder, you know, we're talking about your career in terms of mentors and mentorship. For people who are listening who feel like they haven't found those people in their life yet, what advice can you give to people in terms of how to find a mentor for themselves or mentors?
That's actually a very central question. And actually, Khorshid Mohammed, I want to give him credit. He asked me every 5 minutes at the end of every session on Zoom to talk to the committee on mentoring, because I've mentored a lot of people. And what I've tried to share with the group, which I've also shared with an NBS webinar, is what I'll share with you now. And that is, if you're early in your career, certainly as a trainee, seek out those who I will say not necessarily always agree with you, but who can support your values and beliefs as you're developing. Now, that may mean you'll get someone who's female or male, it doesn't matter, but you have to get somebody who resonates with the ideas that you have. And hopefully you'll do that early enough in your career. Now, that doesn't mean as a faculty member, and I was a chief mentoring my faculty, when you're a little older, you should have a mentoring committee to get promoted and to learn more. I think if I'm going to give any advice to younger members of the NBS, think through who you trust and who communicate well and who are willing to spend the time to be with you. Now, you may find someone who's very useful on day one, but you may outgrow their mentorship a year later. And that's okay. As long as you part friends and move on, that's okay too. But mentoring is a lifelong experience. I call people mentors maybe a little too loosely, but I think that there are some people that I would consider good teachers and even good mentors, even now that I'm in my eighth decade, but certainly good teachers.
It's interesting to make that distinction in words. I don't think we've talked much about that on this podcast, but there is a difference between someone who is mentoring you and someone who is just a really good teacher. I'm wondering, for those listening who maybe are a little bit further along in their career and are questioning themselves, you know, should I be mentoring? Should I be teaching? How do I be a better mentor to someone? Or should I focus on teaching? What can you say to people who are maybe getting to that stage that they want to take on that other role?
Oh, that's important to question to answer, because it crosses fields, not just medicine. So if you're in industry, if you're in any sort of avocation, you have the opportunity to share what you've learned with younger people or people with less experience who may be the same age. And I would suggest that you keep an open mind, even when you're a little older, to seek out those you trust. You may not agree with everything they say, but that may lead to a relationship where you can rely on them for, yes, a patient problem that may be a dilemma, but also a life decision problem or a professional growth problem or challenge. And I think it's important to keep an open mind. I mean, I arrived in Pittsburgh in 83. By 84, I was searching for new mentors. And I found in a woman whose name is Nancy Day, she was an epidemiologist and a psychiatrist. Nancy was doing work on prenatal substance exposure, alcohol, marijuana, cocaine at the time. She opened my eyes to the fact that it's not just the substance that's hurting the baby, but it's the substance that the mother is exposing the baby to, plus herself. Maybe because she's poor, yes. Maybe it's because of a lifestyle, but also maybe because of mental illness, because drug addiction is an illness. And so Nancy taught me a lot about the social disparities or health disparities around substance use. Well, that's a good example early in my assistant professor level career of someone who was a little older than me. She was well-funded at the NIH. And she actually guided me to Dave Kupfer, the chair of psychiatry. I'm giving you that example because I was already a junior faculty. Fast forward when I became more senior faculty in Cleveland, I would seek out Afanaroff, who was the head of neonatology, or Richard Martin, or one of the more senior people who I knew had experiences that either were greater than mine or different than mine. And I would sit down with them. Maybe it wouldn't be a formal mentoring experience, but over a cup of coffee or over lunch or just a conversation in their office, you know, throw out ideas, find out what they think. And if they shut you down, hey, it's private, take it. Don't let your ego get to you. But sometimes that really helped. The NIH writing grants process is a little more formal, but sometimes even when you get rejected from a grant or your paper gets rejected from a journal, you know, you got to pick up the pieces and listen to what they said, because sometimes their criticisms can lead to a success the next time you submit a manuscript or a grant.
It's very, very good advice for people to remember. I'm wondering, before we wrap things up here and say goodbye, what other pieces of advice or topics we haven't touched on that you'd like to share?
Well, I think that we are in an age that hopefully will support and applaud diversity, equity, and inclusion. I really think that has only been a success story, whatever line of work or life experience you have. And I will share at the close something that I think a lot of people don't realize, but many women were researchers in the field of neonatal neurology back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. This is before neonatology and child neurology were even formed. And I'm talking about people like Virginia Apgar for the Apgar score. I'm talking about Lubachenko for growth charts. I'm talking about Dreyfus-Brzak for EEG, or the list goes on. And there are people who have written on women in medicine dealing with neonatal neurology. Diversity, equity, and inclusion uses neonatal neurology where women have been in the forefront as a good example. And I think if the NBS is going to grow, it's going to need women and men, but who respect DEI. And if I'm going to close with anything, don't exclude anybody because they have a different culture, they have a different experience. Applaud their differences and utilize those differences. I'm learning so much from a Nigerian epidemiologist or someone from Tajikistan because they have different experiences coming from their cultures and the things that my dad taught me. So if I'm going to close with anything, DEI is here to stay. It should be.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to share all this with us.
Thank you for letting me reminisce. I appreciate it.
It was very interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Mark Scher is Emeritus Scholar and Professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine and the retired Chief of Pediatric Neurology at UH Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio.
Small Brains, Big Dreams is presented by the Newborn Brain Society in collaboration with the Canadian Premature Babies Foundation. Connect with us at newbornbrainsociety.org, on Facebook at Newborn Brain Society, and Twitter at Newborn Brains. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate, share, and subscribe.